like in a nursery rhyme before pity thoughts wine. Me did wear to me fear upon me face like a shield, like a mask. And everybody take me cool and tell me.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My name is Ashley David. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Today, my guest comes all the way from Brixton, from London, England, originally from Jamaica, Linton Kwesi Johnson. Has been hailed as the first dub poet, as a legend in Europe for his poetry, music, politics, and performance. His books include the 1974 title Voices of the Living Dead, the 1995 title Dread Beat and Blood, the 1980 title England is a Bitch, the 1991 title Me Revolutionary Friend came out in England and was published by Penguin in the Modern Classic series, making Johnson currently the only living poet in the Modern Classic series. And that book is forthcoming in the U.S. from a usable press. It'll come out both in print and with an accompanying CD shortly. He has been awarded the Silver Musgrave Medal in Jamaica, which is the second highest award, the Institute of Jamaica Awards, and that was in 2005. He's toured Asia, South America, Africa, and Europe with his music and band and reading poetry. And when I told folks here at the station that we were going to interview him, I got all kinds of wonderful emails. One of them said his anthem smashed their brains in, provided the soundtrack to many anti-fascist demonstrations in my college days back in Berlin, Germany. And Johnson will be reading when we start in just a moment from Things and Times. And when that came out, one of our DJs was working in the book purchasing unit in the library, and she and a coworker read it out loud to each other as soon as it was unpacked. So welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
The same person who read your book, Things and Times, when she first unpacked it in the library, also said that she had wanted to see you when you read it, the Detroit Institute of the Arts some time back, and she says, he's one of those legends I never thought I'd have a chance to actually hear in person, and so she's hoping to catch your reading here this week. So it's really a pleasure and an honor to have you in the studio with us. Well, as is our usual, I wonder if you would start out by reading a bit from your work.
This is Base Culture for Big Youth, one of my earliest attempts at writing verse. Music of blood, black, reared, pain, rooted, heart, geared. All ten stopped in the bubble and the bounce and the leap and the weight drop. It is the beat of the heart, this pulsing of blood that is a bubbling bass, a bad, bad beat, pushing against the wall, where bar black blood. And is a whole heap of passion a gather, like a frightful farm, like a righteous harm, giving off wild like his madness. Bad out there. Hotter than the heights of fire, living heat down volcano core, is the cultural wave a dread people deal. Spirits riled and rise and rail thunder wise. Latent power in a farm resembling madness, like violence is the show, bursting out a slave shackle. Look ya, bound for harm the wicked. Man feel, him hurt confirm. Man sight, destruction all around. Man turn, love still confirm. Him destiny a shine light wise. So life take the farm where shift from calm and hold the way of a deadly storm. Culture pulsing high temperature, blood swinging hunger, shattering the tightened hold, the falls fold round flesh where we held freedom. Bitter cause a blues, cause a maggot suffering, cause a blood clot pressure. Yet still breathing love, far more mellow than the sound of shapes chanting loudly. Scatter matter, shatter shock, what a beat. For the time is nigh when passion get a high, when the beat just lash, when the wall must smash. And the beat will shift as the culture alter, when oppression scatter.
Thank you very much. That's Linton Kwesi Johnson reading from his book, Things and... Which one is that?
Things and
yeah,
Times.
Things and Times, and that was from a piece that was written in the 70s, I believe. Is that?
That was written in the early 70s, yeah.
And when that was around the time that you moved. Well, no, you'd been in London for a while. Let's talk a little bit about roots. You said in a conversation earlier that your parents came from the generation that the land couldn't contain anymore. They went off to the urban centers. And your mother left Jamaica and went to London, where you joined her when you were 11. And you described yourself as a barefoot peasant boy who moved to London. Oh, what a shock. I wonder if you'd talk to us a little bit about what it was like to leave your island home, go to London, and start writing verse.
I was very excited about going to London. I missed my mother, and secondly, the prospects of going to the mother country, so to speak, was very exciting. And you had a picture book idea of what London was, literally imagining that the streets of London were paved with gold and everyone went around in horse-drawn carriages and and everyone lived in palaces and this sort of thing. I was not prepared for the rude awakening when I got there and saw all these grey, gloomy-looking buildings with smoke coming out of the chimneys. I thought they were all factories. So it was a bit of a traumatic experience, actually. And the shock of my life was to see a white person sweeping the street. Because in Jamaica, where I come from, the old colonial society, the whites are at the apex of the society, and they were the colonial masters. So, in a child's imagination, you couldn't imagine that white people did menial jobs.
And was that sort of a politicizing moment? You joined the Black Panther Party when you went to Goldsmiths College for
Yeah, I went to the University of London, Goldsmiths College. But before that, I went to Tulse Hill Secondary School in South London. What politicized me was just my experience as a black youth growing up in England in a racially hostile environment. It was not very long before you came in contact with racism from school, from the time you enter school, and schoolboys start to abuse you and call you a black bastard and a black monkey and tell you that you live in trees and all kinds of stuff. And teachers with their attitudes. The school I went to, most of the black boys from the Caribbean, we were in the lower stream. The school was divided into three streams, A, B, and C. A was like the middle class kids. It was a comprehensive, secondary comprehensive school. A stream was for like the middle class kids. B stream was for kids coming from semi-skilled backgrounds, parents, and the C stream, working class, immigrants, and so on. I eventually ended up in the B stream, but began in the C stream, where most of my contemporaries from the Caribbean were. And they had low expectations of you. Your parents were invited to do the jobs that the white working class didn't want to do anymore in the post-World War II reconstruction of England. And you were not supposed to have any kind of aspirations above working in the factories or working on the buses or working in the hospitals. It was out of the question to aspire to become an accountant or an engineer or anything like that.
Now, this is important, the post-World War II reconstruction phase of England. That was a time when many immigrants came from the Caribbean to work in these jobs that English people had no longer wanted to do.
And parts of Europe, too.
And that means that the black experience in England is very different from the black experience here in the U.S. It's a totally different history.
Of course, it's a different experience, but what the Caribbean blacks share with our African-American brothers and sisters is the history of slavery and the plantation experience. So we have a lot of things in common.
And so in college you joined the Black Panthers, and that was when you started writing poetry?
No, actually at school I joined the Black Panthers. I was a teenager. I remember the black power salute of those athletes in the 1968 Olympics. And I remembered the only black hero we had at that time for us non-politicized youth was Muhammad Ali. And Then came the assassination of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and Black Power. There was a whole, that whole black consciousness thing was washing both sides of the Atlantic, and it affected nearly all the youths of my generation, black youth of my generation. And that's how I became politically engaged.
Now, when your book was picked up, My Revolutionary Friend, by Penguin Classics and published in the Modern Classics series, which until Miwash's death, you two were the only living poets in this Classics series, the Daily Telegraph, a major London newspaper, said something like, "Dub poet joins the immortals," which took your work from a context. You've called yourself, as you said in an earlier conversation, that you hail from a little tradition. I'd love it if you would explain what that means, because joining this sort of canon of the modern classics puts you in the realm of the immortals.
Well, of course, there's the idea of a great tradition of classical literature, the canon that everybody studies at university and that you have to immerse yourself in to become a poet. But alongside exists other traditions from other cultures, which not necessarily has anything to do with Shakespeare and Chaucer and so on, but has to do with the folk, to do with folk songs, to do with work songs, to do with the word games that children play, and so on. So I was immersed in that, and that's where I began, that's where I came from. And the little tradition is really connected with oral cultures, cultures where orality is still alive, and very much a part of the fabric of the cultural lives of those societies. And I see myself, I've always seen myself as belonging to that tradition.
To the oral tradition. Mm-hmm. Will you talk a little bit more about what that was like in Jamaica? What you mentioned about something about the King James Bible and reading it too.
Well,
and works
the Bible on. is although written... although the Bible is a book, in Jamaica, when I was a kid, and even today, it's very much part of the oral culture. A lot of people who can't read or write can quote you passages from the Bible because you're taught it from Sunday school, parrot fashion, and you learn parts of the, especially the Old Testament, and some parts of the New Testament by heart, and you often invoke that in everyday conversation.
And are these rhythms then the work songs that you heard growing up and the Bible and skipping songs, I believe?
Yeah.
Are these rhythms that inform your aesthetic and your choices, or?
Yeah, these rhythms alerted me to the fact that there is music in language, and. When I was a teenager, I was a big reggae fan, and I was very much interested in the talking tunes. For example, these were just reggae rhythms or rocksteady rhythms in those days with a straight narrative. For example, there was a tune by Prince Buster called the Ten Commandments, where he's using the Ten Commandments from the Bible as a way to make a very humorous rap, if you like, about what he expects from a woman in terms of fidelity and so on. Like commandment number one, thou shalt have no other man but me. Two, thou shalt remember to kiss and caress me, honor and obey me, and so on and so forth. But it's straight talking, you know. And tunes like Ghost Dance, where he's writing a letter to a dear departed friend in the underworld and asking him how things are, what things are like down there, and so on. Amiri Baraka also talks about the talking blues, how that influenced him and gave him a sense of what poetry was when he got started. And of course, later on, there was the reggae DJs who would take a dub version or a drum and bass version of a piece, a popular rhythm, and improvise new lyrics. Often, more often than not, topical about, you know, things going on in the society, while at the same time spurring on the revelers in the dance hall. And those were my first influences before I began to actually read poetry.
Well, let's take a listen, a brief listen to the poem that you read to start the show. Is called Bass Culture, which you also have released on CD as a music track. And let's take a brief listen to that, and we'll be right back. You're tuned into the Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My name is Ashley David. My guest today is Linton Kwesi Johnson. We'll be right back. This is his track, Bass Culture.
Music of blood, black, rare pain, rooted out gear. All ten stopped in the bubble and the bounce and the leap and the weight drop. It is the beat of the heart, this pulsing of blood that is a bubbling bass, a bad, bad beat pushing.
That's Linton Kwesi Johnson with Bass Culture. Linton Kwesi Johnson is my guest today on the Living Writers Show, and you're tuned to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. When the Bass Culture, the poem that you read at the beginning of the show, and that is featured in the song, the track that we just played a bit of, is written in Jamaican Creole, or as Kamal Brathwaite has called it, the nation language.
Or some people call it Jamaican English.
Or some people call it Jamaican English, and you have referred to it as your first language. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about your choice to write in Jamaican English, or your first language.
At first I began, when I started to try my hand at writing verse, I was writing in English. But I felt uncomfortable with it. And some of my early poems that I showed to people in the know said to me that, they're okay. But my early attempts at writing in the Jamaican language, they felt that, those efforts were better. And it seems to make sense to me to write in my first language rather than try to write in purely in English. Those of us who come from places like Jamaica, we're basically bilingual. We have the English language, and we have something else which is not quite English and which is not quite African, but has elements of both. A kind of a hybrid language. And it seemed to me to make sense to use that language. I was comfortable with it, and it was the language of the experience of those people about which I was writing. And it seems to make sense that if you want to communicate to the people you're writing about, you should do so in their language rather than the rarefied language of classical English poetry.
And you've mentioned that a big important piece of your work is writing work that is accessible, that is for the people and of the people you're working on. I've heard you use a quote, people ignore poetry because poetry ignores people.
Yes, an English poet named Adrian Mitchell once said that, and I think he's absolutely right. But people assume that because you're writing oral poetry or you're writing in dialect or whatever, there's no craft involved. Craft is involved in any art form, the criteria or the conventions of composition that is available to one working in an oral context are not necessarily the same as those criteria for one who's writing in a purely scribal context. And I think that's why a lot of literary critics can't really make head or tails of what I write, because they don't know where I'm coming from. They don't have any frame of reference to attack it from.
You haven't given them the ammunition. Well, I wonder if you do occasionally write in English, and not just in Jamaican English, and I wonder if you'd read one of those poems for us and talk a little bit about what goes into that choice when you do choose to switch codes and write. This one is from Me Revolutionary Friend Selected Poems, Seasons of the Heart.
Well, I'll tell you about it first and then read it. The only thing I want to say about this poem, really, is that I hadn't written a poem in English for a long time, and I was wondering if I could still do it. And secondly, I wanted to let people know that I had, in fact, read some English poetry.
Just to show me you were choosing to do what you were doing.
Beguiled by blue moon, oh, enchanting light, we lost our way like lovers sometimes do, searching wide-eyed for wild flowers in the fragrant forest of the night. Now memories slowly drift on by like gray clouds against the somber winter sky, and all our yesterdays are now become the springtime of our days. Life is the greatest teacher. Love is the lesson to be learnt. Like how the heart's seasons shift, how the sweet-smelling blossoms of spring are soon become the icy arrows of winter's sting. How spring, intoxicated by the sun, now throws off her green gown, and summer's golden smile is now become the frown of autumn's brown. How passion spent, we droop like sapless vines in the winter of our minds.
Thank you. That's Seasons of the Heart from Me Revolutionary Friend. Now, when you mentioned that there's craft that goes into any art form, and the kinds of craft decisions that you make when you write a poem in English, which you do very rarely, versus a poem that you make when you write in Jamaican English, are different. You've mentioned before that music, you listen to the music and the words in the music, and sort of those processes go along together. Is that a similar process when you're writing in Jamaican English? Is that similar also for what you're doing when you're writing in...
I'm more self-conscious of it when I'm writing in Jamaican language, because the Jamaican language lends itself more easily to a musical combination because of the inherent musicality of the language itself.
And where do you think that inherent musicality, how is it that Jamaican English has become sort of, or is more musical than standard
I think
English?
It's to do with the African elements of the language. The language has just evolved in that way because of its African elements.
Let's talk a little bit about...
And of course, I guess, in all cultures, there's always a relationship between language and music. I suspect that. I mean, one listens to the way Arabs speak and the way Arabs sing, or the way Germans talk and the way Germans sing. And, I think there's something to be said for that. Idea.
There's something inherently political about the work that you do. You've done a lot of overt political activism. You've been involved in the Black Panthers and in many other groups, and still are.
I came to poetry through politics. For me, in the very beginning, writing verse was a political act, and poetry a cultural weapon in the struggle for Black liberation. And later on, I discovered that there was more to poetry than that. But that's how I began to write. That was my way into poetry. And I was always attracted to the political poets like Pablo Neruda, the poets of Negritude, poets like Martin Carter from Guyana, Kamau Brathwaite, and so on.
And the poets of Negritude being Aimé Césaire and...
Leopold Senghor, Dumas, and Leon Dumas, and...
Now, were you reading their work as you were thinking about writing your own, or were you in conversation?
I was just beginning to get into poetry, and when I began to I hadn't begun to write in the Jamaican verse, and I was writing a lot of verbose nonsense, really. after you've read someone like Senghor, you just get intoxicated with words, you know, and you just write a lot of stuff that... really doesn't make a lot of sense. Eventually, I found my own voice. Not initially when I began to write in Jamaican verse. That took me a long time after, maybe 20 years later, I think I found my voice. It does take some time because you're trying to do something original with poetry, and you don't have a model to model yourself on, and so you're inventing as you go along. It takes a long time.
How did you know?
You feel it. You feel that intuitively.
And is there a poem you can point to that was one of the ones where you're like, aha, here it is?
I think my poem Reggae Fi Dada was one of the first poems that I felt that I was getting close to. Don't ask me to read it now because I don't want to preempt what I'm doing later on today, to find in my voice.
And was it something that came to you as you were writing it, or did you look back on it and say...
After I'd written it, I thought to myself, wow, I've never written anything like this before. This is something new. This is a new departure for me. So it must mean something.
Will you talk a little bit about the quality or what it was that was new and different, where the departure was?
No, I won't talk about that. I hate analyzing my own work. I create it. It's for other people to put their own gloss on it.
Fair enough. Well, when your poetry is, it's important to you. You've mentioned several times that your poetry is of the people, the Jamaican people and the immigrant Caribbean immigrants in London or in England, and that it's important that it be accessible to them. And you've also mentioned that the critics haven't known in some senses what to do with it because there was nothing like it that they could sort of say, ah, this is here. Nonetheless, you've made it into this sort of group of immortals with the Penguin Classics.
All that means is only goes to show that if you're around long enough, sooner or later someone will take notice of you.
Well, they took notice of you a while back. It's been 15 years since they did, and you haven't been around that long. But that's a really interesting straddling of categories.
Well, I'd written, you said I hadn't been around for that long, but it was, I'd been around for about 30 years before the British literary establishment even realized that I existed. I never sought to become a part of that world. I didn't seek validation from the arbiters of British literary taste. That wasn't part of my scene at all.
Will you talk a little bit about what your scene was, what you were?
Well, I was writing verse as I said as both a part of my political and cultural activity, and writing about struggle, some struggles that I was involved in, and using poetry as a way of communicating ideas and communicating experience.
Was it a surprise then when you made it into the sort of British literary canon?
I don't know if I've made it into the British literary canon. I think that was a nice, good marketing strategy by Penguin. but yes, I was in fact, in the beginning, I was very suspicious. I thought, why on earth do they want to publish me? I mean, I've been around for all these years. I've been ignored by the British literary establishment. I had no desire to become part of that scene. But I guess that I'd created an audience, not only in England, but all over the world. And it was inevitable that someone would take notice of that.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the sort of crossover audience experience. You're listening to The Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My guest today is Linton Kwesi Johnson. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My guest today is Linton Kwesi Johnson. We're talking about his work and life and preoccupations and occupations. We were just listening. The music we've been listening to in the breaks and at the beginning of the show has been his own, but the piece that I just played was The Message from Grandmaster Flash, rap artist. And I played it because it was something that I've heard you mention as a piece of rap that you love. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the role or the interrelationship. You've talked about both sides of the Atlantic and the black experience and some parallels in the first part of the show. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about dub poetry, how you see yourself as a musician and a poet and a dub poet, and then the role of rap.
It's a load of stuff to talk about.
Dive in.
to begin with Grandmaster Flash, for me, that was the best rap record I've ever heard. And I've never heard any rapper, do anything to surpass that. And as far as I'm concerned, if you want to be a great rap artist, you have to do something of the same standard as Grandmaster Flash's The Message, because that for me is like poetry.
What
it
is
poetry. The thing about rap is that the Jamaican DJs, people nowadays might know about Elephant Man and Capleton and all these people, but the grandfather of Jamaican, the DJ tradition, dancehall tradition, is U-Roy. And people like U-Roy, they used to imitate the style of the American R&B jive talkers like King Pleasure and Louis Jordan and all these guys. Yeah, until people like Big Youth and another generation of DJs Jamaicanized that art form properly. What the DJs from Big Youth's period onwards did, they were working with dub, which is like deconstructed reggae, a drum and bass style with sound effects, which was very sparse and provided a perfect background for the DJs to improvise their lyrics. It seems to me that what rap has done and hip-hop has done is to appropriate the techniques of dub, and that the rap artists are just doing the same thing that the Jamaican DJs were doing. Sometimes we used to have a Sing J style in Jamaica where a singer would sing maybe a chorus and then the DJ would use that as the point of departure to comment on and make statements. And I see the same thing happens with rap music. So the whole thing has come full circle, if you like. And there's a whole history of relationship between Jamaican popular music and American R&B. You know, we were very much influenced by American R&B music in the evolution of our own native music. Nearly everybody modeled themselves, all the singers modeled themselves on Sam Cooke and Curtis Mayfield and these guys, you know. So, and again, it's the old plantation experience, interplaying with each other.
Kwame Dawes, the Jamaican poet, was on the show earlier this year, and he said that he grew up listening to some reggae songs that were covers of R&B tunes, and when he heard the original R&B tune, he said, "What is that, Tara? What have they done to our song?" it was an interesting sort of, well, no, the original was actually this one. And from the very beginning, you've included music in your poetry, and your first band was a group called Rasta Love.
Yeah, I began with drummers because one of the people who inspired me, I mean, some of the poets who first inspired me were not Caribbean poets, they were African-American poets. People like Sonia Sanchez, Gwendolyn Brooks, Amiri Baraka, Don L. Lee, Langston Hughes, and The Last Poets. And I discovered The Last Poets when I was in the Black Panther movement, and it just really freaked me out. It was these guys doing poetry in the language of the hip language of the street, the hip language of the Afro-Americans spoke, you know, street language, and using it as a valid vehicle of poetic discourse, accompanied by percussion. And I wanted to do a kind of a Jamaican version of the same thing. So I began working with a group of Rasta drummers that I went to school with. I played a bit of percussion myself, and that's how we started. That's how I started public performances.
And you yourself are not Rasta?
No. I went through my little Rasta phase, but I could not reconcile myself to the idea of Emperor Haile Selassie being God, or the notion of repatriation back to Africa. I don't think one can turn back the clock of history. One wants to move forward in time rather than backwards in time.
And that's something that you, when in all the political work that
you've
done.
But of course, I want to emphasize that Rasta was very much an important part of my cultural heritage, because Rasta was did for the Jamaican consciousness what Black Power did for the African American consciousness, because Rasta said no to the colonial domination and posited an alternative way of living and a way of seeing the world.
Let's talk a little bit more about crossover audience. When you were somewhat surprised to find yourself celebrated by the British literary establishment, let's say, it wasn't what you set out to do, that wasn't the scene.
I'm not even celebrated by the British literary establishment, you know. It's just that they've taken notice of me.
Taken notice of you. Well, you're certainly well celebrated around the world in many audiences, Black, white, Japanese. So you've got a very broad audience. And the audience that you initially set out to portray and speak to is a much smaller audience. This is also true with reggae. We've got lots of college kids in particular. Lots of our listeners are not coming from the experience from which reggae hails, but are very much embracing the culture. How do you see the message or the art form working in these different
contexts? All that means is that there's something, there's an element of universality there, and that you don't have to begin with some idea of, oh, I'm going to be universal. You begin with the particular and you arrive at the universal.
Because it speaks to people as opposed to
because it speaks to the human condition.
Yeah. Do you or could you boil down to a couple of sort of key points what you want to appeal to, or what aspects of the human condition you are focusing on in your work?
Freedom, social equality, justice.
And let's talk a little bit about freedom. Only because there's a recent New York Times article in which freedom is a word that we talk about a lot in this country.
It's the most abused word in the United States of America.
Well, that's what this article posits, and it says that that freedom is, for those who have, freedom is about choice. I want more opportunity to do this. And for those who don't have, freedom is more about the freedom not to live in a place that has so much struggle. Will you talk a little about what you mean by freedom and how that informs your work?
I only have one understanding of what freedom means, and that is probably what the dictionary says it means. It means not to be oppressed, not to be enslaved, not to have your life chances limited. There's no other notion of freedom that I know other than the universal one.
Well, let's talk about what's next. You are in the 80s, you started your record label, LKJ Records, and you record various artists, poets and musicians. And you still tour. You're on your way to Medellin, I think, soon, to Colombia?
Yeah, that's by myself, not with the band. I wear two hats. I have one hat symbolizes the literary, and the other the my profession as a reggae artist. And I'm comfortable doing both. when I want to earn some money, I go on the road with the band, and we do gigs. Sometimes we play to as many as 20,000 people. And on the other hand, I do poetry readings where sometimes the audience is as small as maybe 150 people, and they're equally satisfying.
Do you approach them? I mean, I would think the answer to this may be obvious, but how do you approach them differently?
Well, you approach them in differently insofar as when you're on stage with a band, you know it's people have paid money to come to be entertained. And if you're playing in Germany or in France or in Switzerland, people might have an idea of what you're saying insofar as they understand English or understand versions of English. That it's you know, you're an entertainer, so you're there to entertain people. I'm doing the same, I'm using the same material, only that I'm using it with music. And it's less intense because the audience can be focusing on, you know, the drummer or the keyboard player or the horn section. Whereas when I'm doing a poetry reading, you know, it's just me alone on the stage. And I'm like a stand-up comic. It's there are no gimmicks, no antics or nothing. It's just the voice. And I'm either made or broken by the voice. And it's more intimate and obviously more intense.
Well, we are about out of time, but it's been such a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Thank you for joining us. We will be followed up with a sports report. I'd like to thank Jason Adam Voss for sitting in for our regular engineer, Chaz Barrett. And thank you, Linton Kwesi Johnson, for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My name is Ashley David, and we're going to leave you with another track from one of Linton Kwesi Johnson's CDs. This is called Sense Out of Nonsense.
Innocent and the fool could pass between, but horse a horse and mule a mule. Maga mean maga, it no mean slim. Yet the two of them in common share something. Them is often confused and get used. Them is often criticized and compromised. Them is often vilified and reviled. Them is often found guilty without being tried. One thing set the two of them far apart though. The innocent we have a doubt, check things out, and maybe find out. But the fool, sure. And the fool could pass between.